Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ari Barbalat. I'm here today on the New Books Network with an interview with Dr. Robin Hayes, founder and chief creative officer of Progressive Pupil, Black Studies for Everybody. We are here today on the New Books in African American Studies podcast to discuss Robin's new book, Love for Liberation, African Independence, Black Power, and a Diaspora Underground, published in 2021 by the University of Washington Press. It's an honor to have you with us, Robin. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ari. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you kindly tell us about yourself? Can you share with our listeners a bit about your background and upbringing so that we can know you a bit better?
Absolutely. I am from Brooklyn before it was artisanal, Brooklyn, New York, and I grew up in a family that was African-American, Afro-Caribbean, and Latinx. And so in the Republic of Brooklyn, which is, you know, one of the capitals of the African diaspora in terms of having such a diverse community of people, period, and then also very diverse Black community. So I was fortunate enough to grow up in a household where we listened to soul and soca and salsa, and that was sort of the beginning of my interest in, in transnational connections between Black people, and then also the beginning of my interest in social movements, because the conditions in Brooklyn, for my family, where, you know, my grandparents started out, you know, they migrated from the South, from the Jim Crow South, and met and fell in love on a stoop in Bed-Stuy, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and then, you know, started a family in the housing projects, the Ingersoll houses in Fort Greene, and then managed to get their own home in a redlined segregated neighborhood. You know, seeing the struggles of people in my family with class, with gender, with sexuality, with immigration, also sort of lit the fire of my interest in social justice and social movements. So that's kind of how I started out. And then I gained another kind of cultural education when I earned a scholarship to a prestigious boarding school in the Northeast called St. George's School in Rhode Island. In the United States, and I learned about another minority, the 1%, and that's where I learned, you know, to quote Kanye West, that, you know, having money isn't everything, but not having it is, and, you know, what I learned a lot about what relating across difference, and also the things that really do tie people together across difference. And then I went to NYU and I studied at Tisch School of the Arts. And after I graduated from NYU, I joined what I call the Radical Circus, a group called IFCO, Pastors for Peace, that advances a people's foreign policy. And they do that by organizing human rights delegations humanitarian aid caravans to Cuba and Chiapas, Mexico, and Central America. And we actually did a lot of work going, challenging the U.S. embargo of Cuba, going across the Canadian border from Buffalo, actually, and then working with unions in Toronto, and working with unions actually in Montreal to ship things to Cuba from there. And so after that, you know, that was an amazing experience because, again, you know, I was traveling throughout the United States on these humanitarian aid caravans, going from town to town, and in places that are supposed to be red states or purple states, and yet there were these robust communities of activists, people who would fit right in the parking lot in Costco, you know, in Volvo station wagons, who had very progressive ideas and were not only did they have the ideas, they were willing to put their money where their mouth was and their time where their mouth was in terms of being part of the solution. And so that's where I kind of learned you can't really judge a book by its cover, you know. And after I did that for a while, that was a very rewarding experience, but I felt like I was kind of putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg. Like we would, you know, bring tons of aid to Chiapas, Mexico, for example, that, you know, which was affected by the suppression of the Zapatista rebellion, the indigenous Zapatista rebellion. We would bring tons of humanitarian aid and people would be so grateful and they'd put the aid into use right away. And then we'd come back in 3 months and they would need it all again, you know? And so I began to think about how could I, you know, were there deeper solutions that I could think of and affect? And so I went to Yale University and pursued a PhD in political science and African American studies. And it was during that time that I became interested in content creation because I felt like I was learning so much that was so relevant to my Black, Caribbean, and Latinx and queer communities. Like, you know, this stuff is great, but I know, you know, my people back in East Flatbush are not necessarily going to read a 300-page, you know, book full of like $10 words. And so that's when I began making documentaries. And one of my documentaries, Black in Cuba, is actually now available on Amazon. And I did that. And as I was doing that, I was also working first on this project, Love for Liberation, as a dissertation. And then I adopted it into a book. And so here I am talking to you.
Thank you. What an amazing life lived. I'm so impressed by what you shared and the important things and initiatives you have been involved in. How did you become interested in the topic that would become this book? How did you become interested in the relationship between African independence movements and African American civil rights?
Well, I had sort of witnessed the power of transnational connections between communities during my time with IFCO Pastors for Peace, because, you know, we would go stop by stop collecting donations, telling people my program area was Chiapas, Mexico. We would talk about, you know, what was going on with Chiapas. And what was so interesting to me was that, you know, we would go to sort of wealthier, mostly white communities, and people would be generous and give their time and give their aid and give money. But it was never as much as when we went to churches that were mostly Latinx. It was stunning, right? Because you would, you know, go places where it's like clearly folks are first generation American or have recently arrived, and they just felt, you know, invested in the success of these communities and the safety of these indigenous communities in Chiapas in a way that was just very personal and very direct, even though they were in the United States and those folks were back in Mexico. And so that's when I first began to kind of see like the power of that transnational identification. And then I saw a documentary that came out in the 90s. That is a classic documentary. It's called When We Were Kings, and it's about Muhammad Ali and his comeback after being banned from boxing due to his being a conscientious objector in the Vietnam War. His comeback to boxing, which was the, you know, called by promoter Don King the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire, which is now the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. And in that documentary, it's not only about, there's the heavyweight fight between Ali and George Foreman, but there's also this Pan-African festival, and James Brown is there, Miriam Makeba is there, Celia Cruz is there, and I just became fascinated by this period of transnational identification among Black people. Like here was that exact, you know, passion, compassion, and sense of hope that I had witnessed, you know, doing work around Chiapas, but in my own Black community. And so I became very interested in that time, you know, what helped create that sense of identity and connection, and then what happened to it, right? Because I was like, why are we not still doing this? This is great. And especially in light of, you know, there is both the tradition of sort of in the Black community of embracing our African heritage, a tradition that begins or is really amplified and becomes more widespread because of this connection between Black power and African independence. But there's also, you know, a less popular but still consistent counter narrative of like, well, you know, it's Africans or us, or, you know, from the African American community. And so I just wanted to get into, to understand that time better and understand the complexities of that connection between African Americans and people from the continent in particular.
Wow, that's so important. Thanks so much for the investment and inspiration that went into this book. And thanks for the benefit to all of us of the product of that inspiration and investment. Mm-hmm. How did you choose the title, Love for Liberation? Why did you select that?
Mm-hmm. Well, what struck me as part of the research that I did for this book is I had the honor really and good fortune to interview a lot of surviving activists from these movements, from Black Power and African Independence movements. And two things that struck me were, one, that all of them were still committed to the values of racial justice, and we're still doing that work in some way or another decades later. And also that despite the fact that, you know, all social movements, especially when they're effective, go through a period of being sort of mischaracterized as being rageful and angry and dangerous and violent, when usually they're not. And with these activists, it was very clear that they were all motivated by love to do this work, right? Love for themselves, love for their families, and love for their communities. And so I chose the title because, one, I see that same love for liberation, you know, widespread among people who are committed to Black Lives Matter and committed to creating changes today. And there's people from all different backgrounds who have this commitment then and now, but also to really center the conversation away from, you know, what we're trying to dismantle, to what those of us who are concerned about equality want to build. You know, it's a constructive project being for racial justice, you know, and what we build and leave behind, I think, is shown by this relationship between African independence and Black power. What we build and what we leave behind with our activism is the most important thing, is the thing that is most transformative. And so that's why I chose that title, because it really is about a love for liberation.
One theme conceptually in your book is that of authenticity. There's a quote that you have that I only share in part, where you write, "This concept of individual authenticity is more problematic for Black people who have a sense of linked fate with others in their group and are often forced to witness the misrepresentation of their cultures, beliefs, and behaviors because of cultural imperialism. For these communities, the issue of authenticity is concerned mostly with the ability to make meaningful choices about aspects of life that affect their individual and collective selves. this kind of authenticity enables Black social activists and their constituents to create alternative narratives of heritage and relations of power. What do you mean by authenticity? What are you trying to say in this passage? And how does the concept help us understand the argument presented in your book?
I think the concept of authenticity, as we embrace it in mainstream culture, goes back to Enlightenment discourses about the individual, right? And let's face it, not just the individual, the straight white male landowning individual, right? And that, you know, part of the argument for democracy versus monarchy was that the individual, the straight white male landowning individual, deserved free, unfettered, free expression, right? And they deserve a freedom that is about individually doing what you feel is right for you when you want to do it, right? So that's the Enlightenment concept of authenticity, which is an argument against, like, you know, for democracy, against the tyranny, what they felt was the tyranny of the monarchy, of monarchies in general, right? So that is still in mainstream culture. Mainstream culture in the United States, in many parts of Europe, that is still the conversation about authenticity. It's about authenticity on an individual level. It's also an authenticity for white, straight men, right? Women who make claims of, hey, I am get to be me, I want to do what I want to do regardless of gender conventions, are often bullied and punished. LGBTQ folk who say, hey, this is me, I am who I am, right? To quote Lakaja Fall, right? Like, I am who I am my own creation. That is excoriated and sometimes met with violence, right? So it always has been in mainstream culture something that's reserved for a select few, right? This whole idea of individual authenticity. So that's one. Two, and then Black people, right, are, when we tell the truth about our experiences with racial injustice, for example, we are often punished and excoriated and met with violence, right? So authenticity has always been a privilege, a white privilege. And it's also always been something that is expressed as something for the individual. Well, when you're a member of any historically marginalized community, what happens to others, right, is tied to what happens to you, right? And so Michael Dawson is a renowned political scientist, and a classic book called Behind the Mule. He talks about the ways in which Black people have more of a sense. I mean, we are a human race. We're all in it together, as climate change is showing us, right? But he talks about how Black people have a sense, more of a sense of linked fate, because, you know, what happens to one is likely to happen to many, right? So even though, you know, we may not be like Eric Garner selling loose cigarettes to support a large family, right? We know that the police officer doesn't necessarily see the difference, right, between someone like Eric Garner and, you know, another Black man who may be a PhD, right? That's not what's really going on there. So we have this sense of linked fate. And so because of that sense of linked fate, authenticity becomes about the authenticity of our communal experience, right? Not just who am I, but who are we? Who have we been? Who can we be now? Who can we be in the future? And so that is part of what I was talking about there in terms of, like, this idea of authenticity and how it's a little bit different for Black people, in terms of, it's not just about, we don't have the same privilege to think only of what does Blackness mean for me, right? We have to think about it in terms of what does it mean in terms of relations of power in society.
Another key concept in your book is diaspora underground. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the concept to our listeners who might not be familiar?
Yes, well, it's my original theory that I put forward in this book about how and why Black social movements engage across national borders. And, you know, there are a lot of great texts in the field of diaspora studies and African diaspora studies in general, but a diaspora is simply a community that remains, that continues to identify with each other long after they have become physically separated or physically dispersed in different countries. So, of course, there's a Caribbean diaspora, there is a Puerto Rican diaspora, there's an Irish diaspora, and so on. And this book is concerned with the African diaspora, which is people of African descent who also have to contend with anti-Black racism, whether they're on the continent or have been dispersed over generations elsewhere. And I was interested specifically in diasporic connections between social movement organizations and activists. How can people actively working to create social change, how and why do they engage, and what is the impact of their engagement? So a diaspora underground is the spaces in which people engage, the spaces that, in which people sort of come together face to face, but those the interest in meeting, the interest in connection, I've found is really motivated by representations from in communities that are indigenous to the African, institutions that are indigenous to the African diaspora. So specifically in this book, I talk a lot about how historically Black colleges and universities like Howard University and Spelman, as well as Black press outlets. Today, the Black press outlets would be, you know, like BET and Blavity and For Harriet, the blog. These institutions really made an effort to communicate to their constituencies about the successes of social movements in other countries, and also provided a space for example, with HBCUs, provided a space for African and African American students to come together and dialogue about their respective activist struggles. And so you first start off with the indigenous institutions providing this information, and then also you generally have a situation in which activists in their own national context, whether they're in the U.S. or Ghana or Congo, where they're experiencing frustration, right? They have tried to affect change in their own countries, and they are banging their heads against the wall because elites are resisting and keeping them from making progress. So in the case of Black Power, you had, you know, Black Power activists learning about, you know, folks in Algeria and Ghana and Congo getting their own countries where, you know, as James Baldwin, you know, powerfully says, we could not even get a hamburger or a Coke at a lunch counter. Right. And so it would, you know, in the context of being frustrated in their efforts to advance equality in the United States and seeing, wow, look at the alternatives, right? Look what's possible. That motivated them to kind of connect and learn and think about how can we work together in a transnational scope to advance these changes. But another important part of that is that they were able to come together in what I call emancipated spaces, the physical spaces, whether they're conferences or, you know, for example, in Algiers, the Algerian post-revolutionary Algerian government gave asylum to a lot of different liberation movements, including the Black Panther Party. They're able to kind of come together outside of a white supremacist gaze and have conversations about how they can work together and move towards a transnational racial justice. And so, yeah, so that's the kind of diaspora underground, is that it consists of activists who are frustrated in their efforts to achieve racial equality, who are learning from indigenous institutions about successes in other countries, and then come together face to face in these emancipated spaces to build relationships and think about a more liberated future.
You alluded to Ghana just moments ago. Speaking of which, how was Kwame Nkrumah influenced by Marcus Garvey? And how did Nkrumah himself inspire Martin Luther King and other African-American activists?
Well, what's so interesting in doing this research is I found, you know, the period of research is 1975 to 1974 or thereabouts. I should have memorized these times by now, but it's or thereabouts. But what was interesting is when I first started researching Kwame Nkrumah, it turns out that he was actually part of a previous Diaspora Underground, because I talk about in the book how Diaspora Underground, all social movements have what they call in social movement theory cycles of contention, right? No social movement lasts forever in one iteration. You have social movement organizations like the NAACP or the African National Congress. They have lasted a really long time. But if you look in periods of history, they are very distinct, one period to the next. And that's how part of how they've remained successful and impactful is because they've adapted to different historical realities and changed over time. So Kwame Nkrumah goes to the United States and studies at Lincoln University and is going to Harlem. And he's actually in the United States in a pre-civil rights movement period. He's in the 40s and early 50s, just as the Montgomery bus boycott is starting, is when he leaves to go back to Ghana and start that cycle of African independence contention. So he's influenced by Marcus Garvey and the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, one of the largest racial justice movements in history, by the way. He's really influenced by Marcus Garvey's conversation about, you know, the best thing for Black folks to do is to unite across national borders, right? And it's this is coming also from Marcus Garvey's experience and Amy and his wife, Amy Jacques Garvey's experiences as Jamaican folks who had migrated to the U.S., right? That really the best way that we can achieve racial justice is to work together across national borders. And also that that we need to have autonomy, right? So Marcus Garvey, you know, is quite different from someone like W.E.B. Du Bois in the sense that he did not necessarily want to transform American institutions. He wanted to organize Black resources and Black land ownership for Black people to have power over themselves. And so famously, Marcus Garvey had the Black Star Line, which was, you know, the idea was that there was going to be, ships that repatriated Black folks back to Africa. And this was, you know, people have been critical of this because it's like there wasn't really an agreement with folks in Liberia, for example, like that, that they were going to surrender this land. No land had been purchased. It wasn't quite all the way thought through. But it was so powerful and so popular in the Americas, in the U.S. and the Caribbean, because the promise, not just of freedom, but of autonomy, right? Political autonomy and economic autonomy. And so Kwame Nkrumah, you know, was very much exposed to these ideas of Marcus Garvey while he was at the historically Black college, Lincoln University, and also when he was hanging around Harlem and engaging with folks who were having this transnational conversation. And so when Ghana became independent and they got a new flag, the Black Star is still to this day on the Ghanaian flag as a tribute to Marcus Garvey and that transnational idea. So for Kwame Nkrumah and, you know, the movement he was a part of, the Convention People's Party, the idea that Ghana would be independent but also would be a beacon for Black freedom throughout the world, that was always a part of their independence mission.
Moving from Ghana to Congo, what parallels did SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, perceive between the West's non-support of Congo's self-determination and racial inequality in the United States?
Yeah. Well, you know, particularly the first leader of the Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, was a man named Patrice Lumumba. And he was, you know, a leader of the Congolese independence movement. He was imprisoned because of his leadership. He was a political prisoner because of his leadership of the Congolese independence movement. He was tortured. But there was such international support for it was the Mouvement National Congolais, MNC, Congolese National Movement. There was such support for the MNC and Patrice Lumumba that eventually Belgium, the colonizer of Congo, yielded, and you know, they had an agreement that the Congo would become independent. And after Congo, but it was the transition from Belgian colonialism to Congolese independence is really an indicator of how neo-colonialism would sort of take over the continent in the preceding years, in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so neo-colonialism, yes, okay, maybe Belgium doesn't technically own you, but if there is no or very little in the way of true political autonomy or economic autonomy, how independent are you, really? And do the people of your country benefit from the natural resources and human resources that they have? And in Congo's answer, clearly, to this day, the answer is no, right? In this time, months following Congolese independence, Patrice Lumumba tries to honor the democratic process of the country and tries to really keep Congo's resources for Congo, and because of that, the U.S. And Belgium conspire to remove him from power, and he was first taken under house arrest by General Mobutu, who becomes one of the most egregious human rights violators. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say of the 20th century. He goes on to take over power in Congo and be complicit with foreign interests in Congo to his own best interests, not to the people of Congo's interests. And Patrice Lumumba is murdered. And so for SNCC and other Black Power organizations, the murder, including and also Malcolm X and what would become the Organization of African American Unity, the murder of Patrice Lumumba really becomes a signifier of the lack of the U.S.'s intention to make good on their promises of supporting racial justice, right? Because at this time, you know, there's also the Cold War is mounting in terms of its tension. And so there's this competition for African allies between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And so the U.S. works really hard in Africa to appear totally supportive of civil rights and racial equality, right? There's stunning propaganda, right, at the time, going around Africa, you know, making it seem like, hey, you know, we love our African Americans, and you know, the Soviet Union doesn't even have any African Americans, so why would you side with them, basically, right? And but the reality at home, people who are, you know, getting arrested, getting beaten, getting threatened because of their efforts, and the people like activists who were enduring the federal government's often reticent to get involved in local struggles in the South for civil rights and in the North for civil rights. The U.S.'s complicity in Patrice Lumumba's murder really shows a lack of good faith. And also that there's a turn, right? There's a turn in the willingness of elites to escalate violence against people who are really just doing the right thing.
Thinking hypothetically and counterfactually, how might history have turned out differently had Lumumba lived and survived and stayed in power?
Well, counterfactually and hypothetically, which I think might be my new catchphrase. The Congo is so wealthy in terms of its natural resources, right? I mean, I think you can think about it in parallel to a country like Botswana, which has an is the wealthiest country in little, quite as it's kept, is the wealthiest country in Africa because of its diamond wealth. And not just because it has diamond wealth, but because the diamond wealth has been nationalized. So all of the people of Botswana have a claim to the diamond wealth of that country. And so they, you know, have the corresponding longer life expectancies, higher educational attainment, less violence, etc. It's a stable and prosperous and healthy country for the most part, just in general. And so I think there is a chance that the people in the Congo could be living like the folks in Botswana had Lumumba survived. Because the Congo has more than enough to sustain the people in the Congo, right? There is no actual scarcity in the Congo. The scarcity is manufactured by the lack of indigenous control over the resources that the territory has.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for sharing that. Moving towards Algeria, can you comment on the significance of the Algerian War, the French-Algerian War, in your story? One particular figure who you describe is Ali Lapointe. Why is he a notable figure, and how does his story and his contribution figure into your narrative?
Sure. What's interesting, as you say, that, you know, the French-Algerian War, like that's what the French called it, right? Like the French-Algerian War, and the Algerian folks called it the Algerian Revolution. And to me, that was always something that was very interesting in terms of how, you know, history, so much of history is about perspective and about how dynamics of power impact our perspective. So from, and also it goes back to what we're talking about in terms of a love for liberation, the folks in the Front Libération Nationale, the FLN, or National Liberation Front, they just wanted to take Algeria back from the French, right? They considered it to be a restorative project, right? Algeria had existed obviously thousands of years before French intervention. And France thought of it as a one-to-one, you know, struggle. And so, but in the Algerian Revolution, Ali Lapointe became a sort of iconic martyr. And what struck me in doing research for this work was how much he was like Malcolm X, in the sense that he started out, as someone who didn't really have parents to take care of him as a child. And so he wound up out on the streets, and then he became a pimp and a hustler and a thief, and then he was in prison. And it was when he was in prison that he found the FLN, because that at that point, the movement for Algerian independence, you know, was really gaining traction among young Arab Algerian men. And when he kind of came to consciousness, as they say in social movement circles, became woke, when he got out of prison, he became a leader of the Algerian revolution in Algiers, the Casbah, on the streets that he had come to know as a criminal. Now he was still a criminal in France's eyes, but now he was, in his own eyes, a revolutionary. And so part of why he's a notable figure is not just because of his leadership, but because the FLN kind of took him on that trajectory, which is a similar trajectory as like going from Malcolm Little to Malcolm X, growing, discovering who you actually are outside of colonial definitions of what you can be, if that makes sense, right? So he had thought of himself before he came to understand the FLN and its goals and became involved, understood himself as somebody who, you know, didn't deserve more than to be hustling on the street and stealing and robbing and exploiting women. And when he understood, like, you know, this condition is a condition, again, it's not natural, it's not inherent, it's manufactured by colonial expectation, he began to really understand himself as a man, and as a man with values, as a man with someone to contribute. Unfortunately, depending on your point of view, he eventually, you know, in the Battle of Algiers, the French, there's a brilliant film that is fictional, but doesn't feel at all fictional about the Battle of Algiers, called the Battle of Algiers. It's devastating. But unfortunately, during the Battle of Algiers, the French really drew a hard line, I guess is the easiest way to explain it. They began using torture to expose the cells of the FLN and to find its leadership. And also the pressure, you know, the FLN responded to the pressure by having more and more terrorist attacks on civilian locations, which initially they had pledged that they would not do. And the violence really spiraled to the point where Ali Lapointe was hiding with a few other members of the FLN, like within a wall, in a home in the Casbah. And he was discovered and the home was bombed and he was killed. And so his sacrifice to the struggle has become iconic over time, not just within Algeria and France, but I think internationally. But I think a big part of why he remains resonant is how he began. And how much of himself he was able to reclaim through his activism.
What was the significance of the bombing of the Casbah by the Pieds Noirs? And how did the FLN retaliate? How was the bombing of the Casbah significant in the history of the Algerian Revolution? And how did the FLN retaliate and respond?
Well, I think so the Pieds Noirs are, that's a term for white settlers in Algeria. And so this is something that's very interesting to me, why I say, you know, people of African, you know, I describe, you know, to me, a Black person is somebody of African descent who is also contending with anti-Black racism. And I think it's important to be specific about that, because there are white people who are African. Yves Saint Laurent is from Algeria, right? And so I think it's important to recognize, when you have settler colonialism, you have folks who have legitimate claim to the identity. If, you know, like in Zimbabwe, there are folks who are third and fourth, they're of British heritage initially, but they're third and fourth generation Africans. Like, they're African, but they're not Black, right? And so similarly in Algeria, allies of the French in the Algerian Algerian independence were the Pieds Noirs. Many of them were French. Some of them were from other European countries, but they definitely had a strong anti-Arab racist point of view. And in Algeria, and this is something that's not discussed a lot in terms of talking about the conflict, Algeria was a Jim Crow-like or apartheid-like society where, you know, the Arab folks were, their racist stereotypes of the Arab folks were commonplace. You know, there was an expectation of how Arab folks should speak to Pied Noir, which was one of deference. So there was the segregation of educational opportunity, of jobs, all of that. So it was very much an anti-racist revolution. And that element of it is often, I think it's obscured, you know, by the term French-Algerian War as well. But to your point, once the Battle of Algiers, in a way, the violence and torture really backfired against the French, because the radical left in France and other parts of the world became, you know, more aware of what was happening in Algeria. And especially, you know, it's important to remember, this is not too long after World War II and the horror of the Holocaust and the horror of the violence throughout Europe, and the sensitivity about fascism and fascist-like behavior was profound. And so, especially in France, which had been occupied by Nazis, right? So when it became known that France was using, the French army was using torture to stop independence, right? It really turned the Algerian Revolution into an international cause in Europe, America, and North Africa, where other independents, recently independent countries like Tunisia, felt they had to get involved and be supportive. So ultimately, as horrible as the sort of bombing of the Casbah was and the torture, it did rally more support for the FLN and enable them to persevere till they actually won.
I'd like to ask you about Malcolm X, because you pay some attention to his own personal diplomacy with Tanzanian and Egyptian leaders. You comment how his engagement with such personal diplomacy highlights how the face-to-face connections that can be cultivated in emancipated spaces breaks down misinformation propagated by elites, allows for deeper transnational connections between organizations, and facilitates attribution of similarities between groups across national boundaries. What lessons does Malcolm X's personal diplomacy with Tanzania, with Egypt, and with others in Africa teach us about the nature and character of diaspora undergrounds?
Mm-hmm. Well, what's so interesting to me about, you know, there was a time when Malcolm X attends a gathering of African heads of state in Cairo. And this is, you know, after he's been sort of pushed out of the Nation of Islam. And he is really, you know, trying to figure out how he can continue to be of service as a racial justice leader. And he had been to Africa before, and I think in part because of his Muslim faith, he was very open to this idea that there should be transnational connections between Black people that can help, you know, that could help advance Black liberation. I mean, you know, to Islam is a transnational movement in of itself, right? And so, he in Cairo, he learned that, you know, the U.S. has been kind of spreading misinformation about Malcolm X, right? And that, you know, people like Julius Nyerere, who was a leader of Tanzania at the time and leader of the Tanzanian independence movement, kind of think of him as some wild firebrand who's not really serious, right? And so that seems like, okay, you know, and so because he's there is this emancipated space in which he can connect directly, right, outside of, you know, U.S. intervention, right, European intervention, he is able to make that direct contact with with someone in the area's government, and they can see for themselves, right? This is who Malcolm X actually is. This is what he wants to do. And they actually allow him to address the conference, and it's one of his most famous pieces of oratory, Appeal to African Heads of State, where he talks about what's actually happening in the United States with civil rights. And at the time, there were rebellions. There were a few rebellions in northern cities of the United States, and he spoke to that specifically. And so I think, you know, it's really important to see in that example how important it is for Black activists to have the ability to sort of connect in these unfiltered environments where they can learn the truth about each other, because they can be misrepresented and their goals can be misrepresented and distorted to Black activists in other countries.
Understood. Why did Malcolm X rebuke Maya Angelou by saying that carrying placards will not win freedom for anyone? How did their different views on protest differ? And how did this criticism of her embody his larger worldview?
Mm-hmm. So after Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, there were protests at the United Nations organized by a number of activists, including Maya Angelou and Abby Lincoln. And so Malcolm X was the leader of a Nation of Islam mosque in Harlem and was very popular and very well known. And so she went to him and asked him to voice his support for the people of Congo and condemn his Lumumba's assassination and maybe come down to one of these protests at the UN. And Malcolm X was a part of the Nation of Islam at that time. The leader of the Nation of Islam at the time was Elijah Muhammad. And Elijah Muhammad was against political activism, right? This was, so as a minister of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X could not go down there and walk with the other activists and carry placards, right? And so he had to turn her away. But it was at the same time, he spoke of, in his autobiography, he spoke of his increasing frustration with this limitation of the Nation of Islam, right? That here he was being asked all the time to comment on race in America and racism in America and how it impacts Black people. And at the same time, he was not allowed to do anything about it concrete. So once he is pushed out of the Nation of Islam, he had the freedom to become explicitly political in his action, right? Whereas before, he was only able to be a critic. After he was pushed out, he began to find a way to be constructive in terms of what he wanted to build as an alternative.
Who was Fannie Lou Hamer? Can you elaborate on her and her personal story?
I'm laughing because I'm like one of the greatest humans of all time, basically.
Yes. Absolutely.
Fannie Lou Hamer, who was
absolutely.
I don't know, the best. Yeah. So for folks who are not familiar with her, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer was an African American woman who was a sharecropper. Daughter, and I believe a sharecropper's wife, who actually is a really stunning example of what SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, called indigenous leadership, right? And the whole idea of indigenous leadership, I mean, we know about charismatic leaders like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and you know, today we have Patrice Cullors Khan and you know, Alicia Garza and Opal Smedi, the founders of Black Lives Matter. You know, we have the Obamas, right? Charismatic leaders are those folks that, you know, can stand in front of a crowd and electrify, and can be avatars for our aspirations, right? Cesar Chavez, you know, those are or Dolores Huerta, right? Or Marsha P. Johnson even, right? Those are our charismatic leaders. Indigenous leaders are folks who are grounded in the community that is affected by the problem.
Yes.
And have developed relationships and respect because of their willingness to do the work, right? And so I would always joke with my students, like, everybody knows the person who makes sure everyone signs the birthday card, or everyone knows, you know, what the registry is for the baby shower, right? Or organizes the carpool, right? Or, you know, puts together the school play, right? Everybody knows that person in their social circle, the people in their social circle that can be relied on to help advance the collective and get things done, right? And those people are often women, right? And not only solely, but often women. And so Fannie Lou Hamer was such an Indigenous leader. And when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee began organizing in her area and began talking with folks about, would you be willing to help us get people to sign up to register to vote? She got on board, and she became one of their most impactful organizers and leaders. And so unlike someone like Stokely Carmichael or Ruby Joyce Robinson Smith or James Forman or Bob Moses, I mean, he rests in power, recently passed away. She wasn't somebody who came from the North to the South to help out. She was a lower income Black person in the region, in Mississippi, who was trying to transform her own life and her own access to political power. So that was Fannie Lou Hamer. And in the book, I talk about how, you know, during Freedom Summer, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, like many SNCC activists, was attacked and brutalized by police because of her activism, lived in fear for herself and her family, and yet persevered. And during Freedom Summer in 1964, SNCC not only had the voter registration and they had the Freedom Schools, the popular education initiative, they also started the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And the point of that party was to highlight that, you know, because of Mississippi, of course, to this day has a large African-American population, but when Black people are excluded from the vote, you know, the representatives to the Democratic National Convention are all white. You know, all the people on the ticket are white. There's no Black representation. So they started the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and Black people could vote for candidates in that party. And they made a claim that, hey, we are the real Democratic Party of the state of Mississippi. This official one is not official because we're not allowed to vote.
Yes.
And so they went. Yeah. So they went to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, and, you know, they made this claim and they wanted to be on the floor. And Fannie Lou Hamer made a very powerful address to the convention and said famously, she's sick and tired of being sick and tired. And she talked about everything she had been through in terms of being beaten and the climate of fear. And still, in the end, the all-white Mississippi delegation was allowed to take the floor and was recognized as official. And so that was a very difficult movement, a moment for SNCC. It was a crisis moment for SNCC because, you know, this was an example of how, you know, activists reach a ceiling and they start smashing their head against it, right? They had done, in their view, everything possible to affect a democratic change, to have our American democracy function as it should, which is one person, one vote, right? And the Democratic Party turned their back on them. So Harry Belafonte, who had a connection with the leader of Independent Guinea at the time, Sékou Touré, Harry Belafonte, seeing the burnout, seeing the exhaustion and the discouragement, encouraged Fannie Lou Hamer and a few other leaders of SNCC to take a trip to Guinea. And Fannie Lou Hamer talked about how that was a transformative experience for her. And it's important to remember this is 1964, where not only there's no social media, there's barely television, really. Like, television isn't really in color that much, right? We don't have the easy access to information, didn't have the easy access to information and imagery as we do now. She talked about, you know, this was the first time she had ever seen Black airline pilots, or like Black, really Black police officers, right, in a large number, and to see like there's a Black president of the country, and then to be in an environment in which they were not in fear for the first time in years, right, really transformed not only Mrs. Hamer's, but everyone's in the delegation reported having this complete transformation in terms of their thinking about what was possible as a result of their activism. So it really, having that engagement in Emancipated Space of Guinea in fall of 1964 really helped Mrs. Hamer and her fellow activists understand that there was that there was something possible, perhaps even greater than what they could achieve with one person, one vote, and that it was worth it to continue.
In the closing pages of your book, you end with a series of salutes. You write, "A salute to everyday Black people who throughout the African diaspora must use their resourcefulness, wit, and grace to survive against the overwhelming odds. A salute to ancestors who gave their lives in the past so that today's struggle is possible. A salute to those who remain in exile and prisoner on the ground as indigenous leaders. A salute to the miraculous diasporic splendor of Black culture and the ways in which it helps us find joy, community, and self-love. A salute remains a powerful and unifying act because Black suffering and excellence are so often made invisible by the negligence and hostility of dominant institutions. What can we learn from the virtue ethics embodied in the individuals and characters and personalities presented in your book and alluded to in the passage that I've just shared? Is there any particular story, episode, or individual which personally impacted you or that you carry with you as a role model or as a personal inspiration? Can you share some thoughts on what you meant by that passage and the virtue ethics that you try to live by as you learned of them in the characters and personalities that you shared? And what can ordinary people learn from these virtue ethics?
To me, one of the most inspiring things about the folks I interviewed and the folks that I read about in depth for this project was, one, their belief that the world we need is possible sooner rather than later. I think, you know, systemic inequality, you know, whether it's racism or homophobia, sexism, you know, there's classism, there's so much work to do. It can feel like a mountain that can't be moved, you know. And folks like Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer and Malcolm X and Kwame Nkrumah, they were willing to just move that mountain one pebble at a time, mm-hmm. you know. And no one, I think, from that time feels that they succeeded in everything that they were trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, their vision for a truly just society, you know, we're still working on that all these decades later, but there is no question that they did move a part of the mountain.
Yes.
Right? And so to me, that is one of the biggest takeaways, is that, you know, organizing does work. It may not accomplish everything we hope in as fast a time or in our lifetime, but it accomplishes something. And
yes.
that should encourage us to think about what we can improve in our own neighborhood, institution, community, social network, whatever it is, right? Start with that and stay consistent with that. and see what grows. So I definitely salute to that. Salute to people who are, again, maybe not icons, right? Like a Mrs. Hamer or Malcolm X, but the people who are actually doing that work on a small scale, but impactful scale on a regular basis. I think also another thing that I took away is how empowering it can be to have an expansive view of your identity. Uh-huh. So many of the activists I talked to, the Black activists I talked to, really spoke about how much more pride and self-esteem they experienced, understanding that Blackness was international in scope, and that there was more possible when we relate across national differences. And I think that is super important now, because we have so much more diversity, ethnic diversity in the Black community in North America than we have had before, right? So the thing, growing up in Brooklyn, it's like folks were African, folks were Caribbean, folks were Latinx, folks were African American. And you learn so much about the scope of this identity, having all of that to experience and engage with on a regular basis. So I think the more we can think about how we can relate and connect across difference, rather than how we can sort of, you know, dig down in those differences and be in conflict with each other, I think the more we will be able to find solutions that create the world we all need.
Thank you for being so generous with your time, your intellect, and your erudition as to participate in our dialogue and interview today. As we bring this interview to a close, what are you working on now and next? Mm-hmm. Can you share with us some of your current work and engagement since the completion of Love for Liberation?
Sure. Well, I right now am working on a television series called Sandokan, or essentially called Sandokan. That's from the producers of Transformers, The Shield, and Devils. And so hopefully that will be coming to screens within a year or so. And also I am working on adapting Love for Liberation into a documentary series. So those are the kind of two projects that I have coming out next.
Wonderful. I wish you only the best of luck in bringing those projects to fruition and seeing them through.
Thank you so much. And thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you. It was my honor to be in communication with you and in dialogue today. Thank you for your time and for how much you shared with us. To our listeners, this has been Dr. Robin Hayes, author of Love for Liberation, African Independence, Black Power, and a Diaspora Underground, published by University of Washington Press, 2021. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat, with the New Books Network. This is New Books in African American Studies. Thank you.